It's my great pleasure to introduce you to this morning Brian Lehrer from The Brian Lehrer Show and WNYC Radio, which will be broadcasting live into the New York marketplace to several hundred thousand people this morning, this wonderful program. Brian does a daily radio show in New York City. He's a Peabody-recognized leader in radio for radio that builds community rather than divides community. It's my great pleasure to ask you to put off your cell phones and introduce Brian Lehrer. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Kitty. Thanks to Walter Isaacson and to all of you for coming out pretty early in the morning, one of the first sessions that is going to be done here today. I just want to tell you a little bit about how this is going to go, because this is a live radio broadcast in addition to being a session here at Aspen. The way it will work is that we are tied to an actual live radio clock. My station, for those of you who don't know it, is WNYC in New York. That's the NPR station in New York City. So it is 2 hours later there. We will have plenty of listeners there. Often when we do our issue-oriented programs, and my program is an issue-oriented program every day, we would be taking phone calls from listeners. Obviously, we will not be doing that today. You are the listeners, and we will be encouraging and asking for your participation in the education portion of this hour. But also because it's radio, there'll be a few oddities, let's say, here this morning. For one thing, I'll be wearing headphones during the whole session, which is not something you would normally see at Aspen. That's so that my producer over there can whisper sweet nothings of instructions in my ear when need be. We will also be taking 2 60-second breaks during the hour for the station promotional announcements and so forth that take place. And we will have to end on the clock, and on the clock is exactly no later than 59 minutes past the hour. So you'll be watching, in addition to a conference session at Aspen, a live radio show with, you know, with the various implications of that. If you have a question for one of the panelists, write it down on the index card. You may see that there are index cards and, I think, pencils on your table. Hold it up in the air to signal one of the two producers with wireless mics. Are the producers already holding? There they are, and they will be roaming, and they have the wireless microphone, so they'll be able to come to you. First, I'll be introducing, interviewing Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez one-on-one. That will not be a participatory segment. But then for most of the hour, Secretary Margaret Spellings, Eli Broad, and Wendy Kopp will all be talking about education. And after they get to present for a while and we get to talk to each other for a while, that'll be the participatory portion of the hour. And obviously we won't be able to get to all your questions at that time, but we'll try to fit in as many as we can. And we ask you to make sure that the questions are relevant, brief, to the point. Your best 30-second question, as we tell our listeners on the air every day. Let us know who the question is for when we get to you and what your interest in the subject is, if you're an educator. Do we have professional educators in the audience, present or retired? Okay. So you might identify yourself along those lines if you choose to speak, or a parent or someone with any other particular interest, or a member of the press. And if we go to you to read your question, the producer will hold the microphone. So the last line of defense, like at the presidential debates, is if, I won't say you, but your neighbor is running on with a question, someone will hold up a red card. For you soccer fans, that doesn't mean it's a penalty. It just means wrap it up. All right, and one more thing, please turn your cell phones and your BlackBerries on stun. And we will begin. We will be starting in exactly 50 seconds from right now, when it's 11:06 in New York, and the news will just have ended. So we'll get going in just a few seconds. Again, thanks all of you for coming today. We really appreciate it. from the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. It's a special edition of the Brian Lehrer Show today. For those of you listening back east, it is only 9 in the morning out here in the Mountain Time Zone. We are about to begin one of the first sessions of the day at the Aspen Ideas Festival, a session on commerce and knowledge. And let me tell you, at this hour in Aspen right now, people are looking a little bleary. And it's understandable, all this bleariness between the jet lag, the thin air of 7,000 plus feet, and the sheer exhaustion from so many great thinkers thinking so many great thoughts. I think we've solved about 40% of the world's problems in the first 2 days of the festival. Audience, would you agree? About 40%? Okay, maybe 35. But our dependency on oil solved by Monday night. Food shortage Tuesday afternoon around 3:30, I would say. And President Clinton will be here Saturday to solve whichever ones we decide to leave until then. Seriously, it is an amazing experience to be among so many people from government and journalism and science and commerce and education and the arts and so much more who are really dedicated to opening themselves to each other's ideas and really engaging each other on the big questions of our time. We were introduced earlier by mentioning the award that we won recently for radio that builds community rather than divides, and I want to credit the Aspen Ideas Festival for doing the same thing, bringing together people who may tend to disagree with each other on a lot of things, but kind of off the radar of the usual politics and the usual media, to really be able to engage with each other on a very straightforward level and constructive level. Now, for those of you here with us in Aspen, we hope you will participate in the conversation to come on commerce and knowledge. So we'll have people with wireless microphones roaming the audience coming up later in the hour. And U.S. Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez is our first guest. He was appointed to that job by President Bush in November 2004. Before that, he had a wildly successful career with the Kellogg Company, rising up to CEO from his humble beginnings as a refugee from Castro's Cuba and selling Zucaritas to mom-and-pop stores in Mexico. Zucaritas, for those of you not fluent in Spanish, means frosted flakes. Yes, well before NAFTA, Tony El Tigre worked both sides of the border. Secretary Gutierrez, it's an honor. Thank you very much for doing this with us in Aspen today. And since this is the Ideas Festival, is there a central idea or a few basic ideas, philosophical underpinning, that have driven your tenure as Commerce Secretary in terms of trying to bring prosperity to America?
Well, I would say that in our time, what we have seen is an incredible opening of markets that were once closed. You know, 20, 30 years ago, there were markets that were centrally planned, that were not really in a free market mode, and today they are. So I think it is a wonderful opportunity to engage, to be more international, to be more global, to access more markets, and that's something that is paying off. Exports today are the largest percentage of our economy that they've ever been.
Obviously, we're in a challenging time right now economically. Unemployment figures out this morning show another 62,000 jobs lost last month. The dollar, the credit crunch, oil, and the rest. So as you head into your final months in office, presumably, can you reflect candidly on what you think has worked the best and maybe not worked so well in terms of government economic policy these last 4 years or 8 years? Or do you think our problems are just beyond the realm of policymaking?
Well, no, I think there are things that that policymakers can do, and I'll mention that. First of all, we are disappointed with the job loss number. We don't like to see jobs lost. We don't like to see one job loss. Our average number of jobs lost per month this year is about 73,000. And I know that concerns people here, and I want to put that number in perspective because so often you hear things that that put that number in a historical context in a way that perhaps is exaggerated. Let me just say, just put it in context. 73,000 jobs per month. If we compare that to what economists call the mild recession of 2001, that was about 180,000 jobs per month. Having said that, we are disappointed. Unemployment rate is 5.5%. We were, you know, in the high fours not long ago. 5.5% is still below the average of each of the last three decades. Again, to put it in perspective, but we are disappointed. There are three things that we can do, that policymakers can do to help in the short run, in the long run. One is to give businesses predictability, to give them clarity, to give them visibility into the future. Today, there's a great deal of uncertainty. One way to do that is to ensure them and ensure the American public that we are not going to increase taxes. There is so much confusion and uncertainty today about that, and that would be making the president's tax cuts permanent. Second thing we can do is, because exports today are the bright spot in our economy, exports are growing this year 18%. Last year they grew 13%. This is a great time to export. We're exporting $1.6 trillion. We have three free trade agreements that are just sitting in Congress. We can't even get a vote for them. Those would be three new markets for our exporters and would add to our ability to continue to export. The third thing we can do immediately is to decide that we are going to find and produce more of our domestic oil. We are asking the world to produce more of their oil. We should be willing to produce more of ours. That will create jobs in the short term, and it will lower prices, and it will reduce our dependency on foreign sources of oil. Those are three policy issues, questions that we can take up now.
And obviously people will disagree on the president's tax cuts and offshore drilling domestically, and I think we'll leave those debates for another day. But I do want to get into two policy areas with you, immigration and trade. And you mentioned the opening of markets as being so central. One of the issues facing America and the world today is the rising price of food. And you spoke at a press conference last month on the state of immigration, and you said, quote, "We don't have enough domestic workers to keep America fed." And that quote blew me away. We don't usually think of immigration and food shortages in the same breath as being part of the same, you know, policy area. So can you elaborate that on that idea for our audience here in Aspen and on the radio? And that connection, did you mean literally that we don't have enough domestic workers to keep America fed?
I remember saying we don't have enough domestic workers to keep our economy growing. I don't remember saying that, but let me just respond to immigration. What's happening today is because so much of our immigration brings in low-skilled workers, it's low-skilled and high-skilled, but in this case, low-skilled workers, to work farms, you know, to do jobs like picking lettuce and working on farms. If farmers can't find workers, then they're left with a couple of choices. One is to go out of business. The other one is to move their farm to Mexico. And we have already seen farms moving offshore, so moving to a country such as Mexico, which would be next door. So that's one implication of the immigration problem. And it's happening today when not only is it in our interest to produce as much as we can because supply helps take prices down, but it's also a time when we have a national concern about food quality and food safety. So, yes, immigration will impact our ability to produce more of our own food.
And one of your own stats from that same event, to elaborate on what you just said, that the Western Growers Association gave you, that American companies now farm more than 45,000 acres in Mexico, employing 11,000 people. But did you mean to suggest that farming should be taking place here? I mean, we fret so much these days about dependence on foreign oil. Do you see the labor situation shifting us toward dependence on foreign food?
Well, we have a very strong and very efficient farming industry. We have some of the world's most productive and most efficient farms. And, you know, I would suppose that those farmers, those owners, would like to keep those farms and would like to continue to grow those farms. And in order to do that, they need workers. And what they are asking us to do as the government is, listen, give us a legal means by which we can hire workers. Because maybe 50, 60 years ago, high school students or perhaps even high school dropouts welcomed those jobs and wanted to go out and do those jobs. Today, I think Americans have actually moved on to other types of jobs, and we do not have enough Americans to do those jobs. And so that is a numerical reality.
We're talking in the same breath this morning about an increase by tens of thousands in unemployed Americans and a labor shortage. How do you square those two?
Well, that's a good question. Let me put that into context. The unemployment is 5.5%. If you look at the unemployment among people without a high school diploma or only a high school diploma, the number is well above 6%. If you look at the unemployment with people with some college or a university degree or a master's or a PhD, that number is in the threes. And the threes is about as close to, you know, full employment as you can get. So clearly there is a difference in education level and the types of jobs that are available.
Secretary of Commerce Carlos Gutierrez, my guest here on WNYC at the Aspen Ideas Festival for another few minutes. Then we will talk to the Education Secretary, Margaret Spellings, Eli Brode, a philanthropist very involved in education, and the founder of Teach for America, Wendy Kopp. So, Mr. Secretary, let me tie the food question and the immigration question back to trade, because as a proponent of free trade agreements with Latin America and elsewhere, are the administration's trade policies making it easier for agribusiness to outsource the American food supply?
Actually, what our trade agreements do is they make it easier for our farmers to export. 30% of what we produce in our farms goes to exports. 30%. That's a big number, and that's a very important number for them. I'll give you one example of why these agreements are so important. We haven't been able to convince our Congress to put the Colombian Free Trade Agreement up for a vote. Our exports go to Colombia with duties. Their exports come into our country duty-free. We've been waiting for 500 days. In the meantime, Canada jumped in, and they signed an agreement with Colombia. That means that Colombians will be buying Canadian wheat instead of buying U.S. wheat. So we need those additional markets to continue to export.
Just one challenge on NAFTA. Let me read to you from an Associated Press story last month, Monday, June 9th. This is very much making the rounds online, especially among opponents of NAFTA. Headline, Mexican unions to cut wages. And it says, Mexican wages are being pushed down so plants are competitive with China. Mexican auto unions are taking a cue from U.S. labor leaders by offering two-tier hiring schemes and salary cuts that bring already low wages down to near Chinese levels. As more automakers turn to Mexico, a big argument for NAFTA in 1993 that Mexico's low wage rates would slowly rise to close the gap with U.S. wages seems to have been thrown in reverse.
Well, I haven't seen that. I'll tell you, I managed a business in Mexico for 5 years. I don't remember a union ever asking me to take wages down. But
they've agreed to the point of this article is they've agreed there as here to two-tier wage where new employees are working at lower wages.
Let me just give you, because a lot is said about NAFTA and a lot of one-liners and a lot of, you know, just a sentence to describe something that's extremely complex. Let's look at numbers. The 14 years before NAFTA, our average unemployment rate was 7.1%. In the 14 years after NAFTA, our average unemployment rate was 5.1%. Our growth in the 14 years after NAFTA exceeds the growth in the 14 years before NAFTA. NAFTA is 30% of our foreign trade. We wouldn't have those numbers if NAFTA weren't contributing. NAFTA is now a $1 trillion relationship. There are a lot of integrated information systems, a lot of integrated supply chains. So when I hear people say, well, either we're going to renegotiate or we're going to opt out, you can't do that in a $1 trillion relationship where you have integration, you have businesses that have been working for 14 years to become more effective.
So just one more number from the article. It says, with labor costs like these, Mexico is staying competitive with China, where an average worker at a foreign-owned factory or joint venture can make $2 to $6 per hour. Is there a problem there?
I think one of the realities that we also need to think through is, as we look at countries in our hemisphere, what we have found is that very often those countries are complementary to our economy. So in the case, for example, in Central America, we would send them raw materials, and they would we would send them cotton, and they would send back a finished product. If they weren't producing that cotton, probably Vietnam or China would be, and then we wouldn't be selling them our raw material. So they are competing more with China than they are with us. And in many cases, they actually complement our supply chains.
Last thing. This session is commerce and knowledge. We will hear from our education guests next, as I said. In your opinion, maybe agricultural workers aside, is America training the next generation to be the workforce you would like to see for the changing economy?
Well, I know that Margaret Spellings will talk at length about this. We always need to be doing better and better and better. And she'll give you the statistics on education. So we need to do a better job in preparing our people to compete in what is clearly going to be an even more competitive world. We also need, to the point you brought up, we also need to confront what is our policy on immigration. Because we have always attracted the world's greatest scientists, and they have helped us. They've helped us out throughout a number of years. You can point to very key innovations and foreign scientists who came over, who decided to make their life here in the U.S. and contribute to our country, have been behind that. And you see that today in Silicon Valley. So we need to have a comprehensive immigration policy that takes into account that if we want to grow our economy long-term and really have an advantage, we need to have a combination of our own pipeline of students and foreign students as well as low-skilled workers.
U.S. Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez, thank you so much for joining us on the stage at Aspen today. And coming up in a minute, it will be the U.S. Education Secretary Margaret Spellings with education philanthropist Eli Broad and the founder of Teach for America, Wendy Kopp. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer from Aspen on WNYC.